is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
This is Kip Ione, head men's basketball coach at Willamette University, founder of Teams of Men, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
What is our goal for Wisconsin women's basketball? It's that consistency to be in the picture for a Big Ten championship year in and year out. And you know what? I only have to walk about 15 feet across the hall to see that consistency.
Jonathan Sippas is the women's head basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin, taking over the program on March 31st, 2016. In his 4 years, 5 Badgers have earned 8 All-Big Ten honors, while 27 have earned academic All-Big Ten honors, including a record 10 players in 2019-2020. 2 athletes have also recorded 1,000 career points in the past 4 seasons. Prior to Wisconsin, Sippas spent 4 seasons as the head coach at George Washington University, reestablishing the Colonials as a national power and a dominant team in the Atlantic 10. He inherited a team that went 11-18 the year before he arrived and led them to a 55-11 record, 2 A-10 titles, and consecutive NCAA tournament appearances in the last 2 seasons. In his 4 years at GW, he was 92-38. Sippas arrived at George Washington after serving on the coaching staff at the University of Notre Dame for 9 seasons, where he worked under Hall of Fame coach Muffet McGraw. Sippas aided the Fighting Irish to 5 Sweet 16 appearances, including national runner-up finishes his last 2 seasons. Sippas went to Notre Dame after 1 season as the director of men's basketball operations at UNC Greensboro, where he worked under Fran McCaffrey, now the head men's basketball coach at Iowa. He spent 2 seasons as an assistant men's coach at Elon University in North Carolina, and 1 year as the top men's assistant at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York. Sippas also spent 3 seasons on the men's basketball staff at Cornell University and 1 year as student staff assistant at Duke under legendary coach Mike Krzyzewski. Don't miss our free Hoopheads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, and our newest show, Jazzology. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Get ready to listen and learn from Jonathan Sippas, head women's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, who is relieving his wife on baby duty. But I am pleased to be joined by Jonathan Sippas from the University of Wisconsin Badgers, the head women's basketball coach. Jonathan, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. Looking forward to our talk.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to have you on, talk about the varied experiences that you've had in the game of basketball throughout your coaching career. Want to start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Talk to me a little bit about your experiences as a youngster playing basketball. I know your dad was a member of the Greek national team at one point. You had some siblings that played athletics in college. So just tell us a little bit about your upbringing in the game of basketball.
Yeah, you know, I'm the youngest of 5, and you know, my dad, as you mentioned, was Still holds the record for being the youngest member ever of the Greek national team. So I have a daughter now who's 15, and to think he was playing on a national team at that same age is pretty amazing. And he's held that record. And basketball's obviously, you go back to that point of that's how it started to get into our family. He played basketball in Greece and then had the opportunity to come over to the United States, more of a get him out of the country during the Greek Civil War. My grandfather was actually the chief of police of Athens, and they were concerned that both my dad and my uncle could be possible targets. And so they kind of snuck him out of the country. It always is good for anybody in our family when they're doing a family history project about that journey. My grandmother was over here, and he lived in kind of the projects of Cleveland, and went to, at that point, what was St. John's Cantius, which is now part of Cleveland Central Catholic. So he played there, played at Baldwin Wallace when they were playing against all Division I teams. And like you mentioned too, I'm the youngest of five. I have a brother who's 14 years older, who played at Case Western Reserve. I have a sister who's 10 years older, who at the time was, we joked in the family that she was, Bo Jackson / Deion Sanders before they became famous, because she was a three-sport athlete in college, played volleyball, BW, played basketball, and then also was a thrower on the track and field team. So
there's not many of those left anymore.
No. And she had never – nobody throws a javelin in high school. And so they asked her if she would try it, and she tried that. So she threw the javelin as well. But being the youngest of five and having that age discrepancy, I can honestly say I never had a babysitter growing up. My dad, after he was done playing, continued to coach, really felt to be able to give back and officiated, actually, officiated in the Senate League in Cleveland. And so usually a game, whether it was a siblings game or my dad was coaching or he was refereeing, that was my babysitter. And so I kind of grew up in the arms of basketball, and played when I was young, and played throughout, middle school and high school. We moved. My dad retired before my junior year in high school. And so actually, I'd be a red flag in today's recruiting world, because I went to three high schools in 4 years. So, so I actually went to Highland High School in Medina County in Northeast Ohio, and then Western Reserve Academy for a year, and then finished in North Carolina at Durham Academy, and had to make a decision. Was not the biggest guy in the world or the quickest, but had a love of the game. I had a pretty good IQ, I think, for growing up around the game. But I decided to go to North Carolina and started actually coaching going into my freshman year of college. So my high school coach asked me to come along and coach the JV team when I was 18 years old, and then started coaching younger kids, but still played a lot. Just knew I had no misconceptions. Didn't think I was going to, become the Rudy of North Carolina basketball and walk on or anything like that. So,
well, it was probably a good place to find a pickup basketball game, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yeah, and had some really fun. Played against Carolina women's players. Played against, one of my claims to fame in high school is on one of the, the local papers, players of the week, Rodney Rogers, who was obviously a great player at Wake Forest and went on to the NBA, and I were co-players of the week.
Nice. One week, so. There you go. That works. So,
I've always, I love the game, I set my schedule up to be done with classes by noon every day my freshman year, so I could just play the whole afternoon. And got to meet some of my best friends in the world that way. And then when the opportunity came kind of at the end of my freshman year to start coaching 9-year-olds kind of year round, not necessarily an AAU team, but a group of, just like a lot of things in life, connections are so important. And I was fortunate. My high school, Durham Academy, is where Tommy Amaker, when he was an assistant at Duke, would run his summer camp. And then the dad who started this kind of group of young kids and searching out, trying to find somebody that could coach them year round, was a doctor at Duke who was pretty tight with Coach K. And Actually, I'm thankful that Kenny Blakeney turned it down. He was the option number one.
All right, there you go.
And but got the opportunity to start coaching those kids, and really just continued to do that, and started my own camp, and was able to do that in the summer, and then my first kind of breakthrough as far as coaching goes was. The doctor had kind of asked, what did I want to do with basketball moving forward? Was it something I wanted to do after I graduated? And I was a pharmacy student, you know, and thought that was going to be my kind of livelihood. And I said, I'd really love to try to continue to do this. And kind of that led to a conversation that he had with Coach K. And so I got an opportunity to be a student assistant and be at every practice. And it was an unbelievable experience. I don't think you could pick a better year. I got to be, you know, a student assistant in 1996, 97. And that was Coach K's year coming back, off of back surgery. And so he was just rejuvenated and had two brand new assistants. One of them you may have heard of, Quinn Snyder, was his first year as an assistant. And, he's just exactly what you see as a coach now, high energy, wants to help. And Coach Amaker was kind of, you know, the veteran of the staff, and Tim O'Toole was another just high energy coach, and I was around them and did a lot of film work and just tried to absorb as much as I could, and had an opportunity to go visit my sister out in Kansas, who happened to be neighbors with the Wichita State men's head coach, and kind of that connection ended up when I graduated. You know, Mike, I had prepared for 5 years to take the pharmacy boards and had got a chance to interview for a position at Cornell, and kind of the time frame was we were still running camp, and there were no cell phones then, or if they were, I wasn't to the point where I could get one, and maybe I could get a Zach Morris phone and have a brick phone carried around. But interviewed with Coach Thompson and ran camps the rest of the summer, and on a Friday got the results from the Board of Pharmacy that. In North Carolina, if you pass the Board of Pharmacy, there were two different people that administrative assistants that sent letters out, and one would actually put your name and then comma RPH if you passed. One wouldn't. So my mom called the school because I said, like I said, there are no cell phones, and the school came and got me, and she said, well, I think you passed. It says RPH on the outside of your form. I'm like, open it up. There might be a mistake. And so I found out on a Friday on the last day of camp that I legally become a pharmacist. And on Monday, I got offered the job at Cornell. So it was short-lived.
And, your pharmacy career was quick.
It was quick. I kept my pharmacy you know everything from a certification standpoint active for 11 years. Wow. more to I think appease my mom that I had actually was studied hard in school. I will tell you the greatest thing from pharmacy school is I met my wife in pharmacy school.
There you go. There's nothing better. It was well worth it just for that, right?
Absolutely.
There's a lot of stuff to unpack on what you just said. So I have one question that I have to ask, even though it's not directly related to you, it relates to your dad. Did your dad ever tell you, because I ask everybody who played overseas for their craziest overseas basketball story. So what's your dad's craziest overseas basketball story that he shared with you? Does he have one?
You know, I think the most interesting thing he's ever told me about playing overseas is he took me to games when I was I've been to Greece. So I was in Greece when I was baptized there when I was 1 year old. I don't remember that trip at all, but, so I think the craziest story, he told me, is that he had the opportunity to stay there, but it was so important to start his family and be stable and everything, that they stayed in Ohio. He went back right after he graduated, but I, to be honest, I think the craziest story comes from my brother. So in Greece, the fans are a little bit different than they are in the U.S. And my brother, after his senior year in college, got to play on a Greek-American all-star team. And they toured all over Greece. And he tells this great story of, the two rival teams are playing. So in Athens, there are several teams, but the two kind of biggest ones are Olympiakos and I think PAOK were playing. It may have been Panathinaikos, but two rival teams are playing. They're playing in the old Olympic Stadium, so outdoor. And my brother is at the game, and he said They sit on each side so that they don't fight, and then nobody sits kind of in the end zones. And he said, but the, as the game goes, the fans like just start making their way towards the end zones. And then the riot police come and send them back and everything. And then they would continue to do that. And then at one point that somebody threw a flare onto the court, and there's a big 7'2" guy, my brother said, who like chased the flare around. He was like the jester of the game. But I've gotten to see 3 or 4 games, and I think my dad probably censored some of the things that were being yelled at by the fans.
Probably.
But seeing coins thrown on the floor was something I don't think I've ever seen in a game in the States. But it's amazing because I think smoking as well is something that later on in my career, it kind of passed along generation. We played when I was at George Washington, we took a team overseas, took our team on a foreign trip. And one of our players is like, boy, that team was really bad in transition in the second half. And as we're walking down the stairs, we see two of their players walk out before they even get in the locker room, and they're smoking cigarettes outside. So my dad just tells some of the stories of being that young and, you know, being 15 or 16 and playing on a national team and, you know, playing with 30-year-olds. And I mean, he's at his prime. He was 6'2", but he was a post player, you know, and so we're fortunate enough living in Wisconsin that, you know, Giannis is obviously a huge deal across the country, but even more so in the state of Wisconsin. And we like to refer to Giannis and our family as the Greek Freak 2.0.
The original, right?
Oh, yeah. My dad is definitely the original Greek Freak.
That's awesome. That is very, very cool. I just think anytime I get a chance to talk to people about those stories, inevitably everybody has one, whether it's the fans or it's not getting paid or it's some crazy travel trip and riding a bus that's about to careen off the edge of a mountain or whatever it might be. Everybody always has a good story. So I wanted to make sure I got that in.
Well, the other thing I was going to add, and this is my dad put his foot down and would not endorse my brother playing in Greece because on that same trip, there's a gentleman by the name of Nick Gallus, who it was considered at the time kind of the Magic Johnson of Greek basketball. And you talk about not getting paid, and he was in their championship series, he was averaging, I think my brother would say, like 35 or 37 a game. And in the final deciding game, he had 31 and he didn't get paid. And the people said, you know, the owner was like, he didn't even get his average. Why should I pay him? So my dad's like, listen, when they're not paying the best player in the country,
yeah, right,
you're not going to see a lot of money if things don't go right.
Exactly. Especially back in those days. I think it's a little bit less like that today, but I know back then there was a lot more chicanery that went on in terms of having guys come over and then trying to get your money and who's going to get paid where. And it's just there's inevitably something crazy always going on. Next thing that I wanted to ask you about is getting that opportunity at Duke as a North Carolina guy. How did that go over?
I will tell you, it almost cost my future wife, because she's a diehard Carolina fan, you know, camped out for tickets. We were pretty quiet about where I went to school while I was there.
You weren't accentuating that on the resume?
No. Okay. No. It was really interesting, I think, because one of the first practices, kind of after everything cleared, I just said to Coach K, I said, I really appreciate this opportunity. And he was very quick to say, a lot of people want to help us. And he goes, just make sure you take full advantage. And he said, you know what, I think learn as much as you can, but when we need a hand with something, I don't need to be the one to ever ask you to do it. And so, you know, I have great respect. I think that the managers kind of took me in, and when they were maybe over Christmas break, when they didn't have their full staff there. And I was really lucky too, because just again, by happen chance, I got to meet, you know, Chris Collins when he was a freshman, because he lived two doors down from the girl I was dating, who was a sophomore at Duke. And so I knew him right away. It was his senior year. He actually came, that same group of kids I coached, and talk to my kind of seventh grade group of kids before a game. And but I appreciated that. It wasn't a, hey, I want this to be on my resume. It was, you know, I wanted to try to learn, and Coach K might come up and say, I want to tape, you know, before the days of Synergy, you know, I, one of my job, anything we could find on any type of, you know, that was on TNT or TBS, any NBA games. I was in charge of getting those put on a VHS tape and logging them. And if he wanted to look at something, try to break that down so he could kind of see, you know, I think one thing you learn as a coach is you got to be a continuous learner. And yeah, absolutely. It's pretty neat to see. I thought I was going to walk in and see Albert Einstein diagram and things on the board. And it's still, you know, I think that was, he started, you know, it was so much man-to-man, you know, pressure defense and motion offense. And it's been neat to see how the game has changed, how he's adapted to the players that he has.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think the overall game of basketball has clearly evolved and adapted. I've said this a bunch of times. I think back to, I'm 50 years old, so I think back to when I was playing, and I've said, I don't ever remember in my entire career driving to the basket and then throwing the ball back out behind me to the three-point line. I never remember making that pass ever. And I kind of grew up both in high school and in college kind of playing a motion offense. And I think I maybe played in the pick and roll four times in my entire career, and it just wasn't done. And then now you think about how important that is in the game and just how the three-pointer has changed it and evolved, and it's really incredible. And then obviously the best coaches have figured out as the game evolves, they're evolving either right along with it, or in many cases, the best coaches are evolving ahead of it and trying to see where those trends are headed. So my question, going back to the Duke experience again, obviously that's the first time that you get an opportunity to be behind the scenes with the coaching staff. Pretty good coaching staff to have your first opportunity to look at what it's like to actually coach and run a college program. So is there anything that you remember from that early time that was surprising to you, that you were like, man, I didn't know the coaches did so much of this, or I had no idea they even did that? Was there anything that just jumps out at you that was surprising?
I think two things. One thing, you know, when Quinn Snyder started as an assistant at Duke, obviously had a great career there, has a double, you know, has an MBA and a law degree from there, combined degree. Really seeing him, you know, he had already been an assistant coach in the NBA at that point for Larry Brown and the Clippers, but to see how he had to kind of start at square one of the recruiting process. And I think a lot of people say, well, it's Duke, it recruits itself. And I just, there's a lot of things I can remember of him having on flip charts of, you know, why Duke, why you separate whatever school you're at to make it, you know, to understand that in the recruiting process, you start with somebody with even thinking they have a blank slate, and why it's important not to take any of that for granted. And then I think all the things that happen behind the scenes, and whether it's, you know, that was my first experience with, you know, what film exchange was. And, you know, it really helped me get a better appreciation kind of in my journey of never forgetting those people that are doing those things. Like, I think a lot of players, when they come out and they get into coaching, they're amazed because, you know, no matter what level, like all of a sudden, like their food was always there, or, you know, the hotels are booked and you just get handed a hotel key, and, you know, even how the gear and how you get it and figuring everything out. So I think from the Duke standpoint, to me, you know, the one thing from Coach K was his ability to motivate. That was, to me, I watched him, you know, turn, Jeff Capel into somebody who had been to a national championship game as a freshman, and Chris Collins as a sophomore, to they'd really had that tough year that he was out, and how he was able to not only motivate, but make them better leaders that help some of the younger kids on that team, which was, you know, Eric Newton and Cherokee Parks and Ricky Price. And so it's just amazing. And just seeing his one-on-one interactions and trying to not be too close, that you felt like you're intruding, but trying to listen and talk about how he was able to, you know, transfer the experiences he had had, not just to kids individually, but the leadership. And I think the more I you know, like when I read the gold medal standard, you saw how then he was doing the same things, but now he's doing it. But he was a more, even more of a listener, I think, to when he had, and didn't try to reinvent the wheel, you know, with people like, you know, LeBron and Kobe, and when he coached those, you know, the players at the highest level, you know, on those, you know, when he was the national team coach. So, you know, I think just understanding, like I worked for a coach, the director of operation, who had been his assistant, had gone on to William and Mary as the head coach. Things didn't go well. He'd been back at Duke. It is to watch somebody too have to kind of reinvent themselves in basketball, while other people are coming through for the first time, like Tim O'Toole. And it was really personalities. I think I always know too, like Coach K always talks about when he had to kind of reconstruct that staff, you know, he talked about all of a sudden I was the old guy on the staff and I had to make sure I had better connections. And he goes, that's why I needed somebody like Tim. And I needed, you know, it was just as important to have Tommy be able to help train them as much as me training them. And that's something I think I've been put in that same position. And so I think I understood that a little bit more when I got to Notre Dame and moved up and then was in a position where I had two younger assistants that were assistants with me, and kind of what Coach McGraw kind of challenged me that would eventually, I think, help me make me a better head coach.
All right. So I want to touch on something you said with Coach Krzyzewski, and that is when you talked about how good he was at the motivational piece of it, both with his players and his staff. If you had to put your finger on one key to it, and there may be multiple keys, but if you had to think about one thing that makes him a master motivator, I know you mentioned listening. I know you mentioned one-on-one conversations. Is there something that you could point to that you would say, this is what makes him as successful as he is as a motivator? Is there one thing you can point to?
I think no matter who he was talking to, he could always incorporate how the team could accomplish more. And that was the most important thing. And it sounds really simple, Mike, but I think when you have a McDonald's All-American and all they've heard about, no matter how much they've won, is how good they are. And they needed to, you know, average this, or this is what they needed to do to put themselves in a best position to you know, be draft, you know, be in a position to have the right NBA team and everything like that. He was always able to, I felt like, in any message he had, talked about the importance of one, how, you know, I always use the, I stole the phrase, like as a coach, one of the greatest goals we always have is being more than the sum of our parts. And I think he always was able to get that through. And honestly, you know, that team wasn't a great team. I think they ended up 18-12 and lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But I think he got more out of that team. And again, you know, Steve Wojciechowski was a sophomore on that team and was coming off the bench. He's not the Wojo everybody knows now, that how he finished as a junior and senior. But to me, I think that collective buy-in, he's just so deliberate, so consistent with it. I've never, you know, I've not had anybody who's had a military background outside of my father-in-law. But again, I think you always saw that, you know, his West Point training, just with the consistency and the detail oriented and that same message, you know, and obviously he drives people hard, but, you know, he had to make changes, and I even saw it that year. And it always came back to that, of getting the most out of the team was was always going to be number one. And how could he get everybody up to that level with the understanding what they were doing collectively was going to get you to that level.
Yeah. And I think what's amazing is that hearing you talk about those players and that team, and you think about the fact that that's 25 years ago now, and clearly you have a very good memory for the details of what went on in that year. And I have a vague recollection of some of the details as you're talking that are coming back to me, and Krzyzewski missing the whole season and then coming back and sort of being rejuvenated. And then now here we are 25 years later, and he still is continuing to adapt and adjust and be successful. And obviously his success with the Olympic team speaks to his ability to be able to adapt to players at all different levels. Clearly coaching a bunch of college guys, no matter whether they were McDonald's All-Americans or not, is different from coaching Kobe and LeBron. It just is. And the fact that he was able to find that success as a college coach transitioning up to coach NBA players in the Olympics is a credit to what he's done. And just from hearing you talk, clearly I can tell that those things that you learned in that very first year are things that you are continuing to carry with you even today, 25 years later. And that speaks to, I think, the greater influence that any coach can hope to have, both on their players and in this case on somebody who's a part of their staff. And I think we'll get to it when we start talking about you as the head coach. But I think that as a head coach, one of the things that I always like talking to head coaches about is how they help to develop their assistants, both as in their role as an assistant, but for those guys or those women who want to go on to get a head coaching job later, how does the head coach help them to prepare for that? So let's jump into your assistant coaching career. And you get offered the job at Cornell. You give up your dream of having a pharmacy career. Talk a little bit about what your experience was like there in Ithaca with Cornell.
Well, you know, I was really lucky because I already, you know, I had met, the head coach and, obviously Scott Thompson goes from being let go at Wichita State to getting the job at Cornell. And, as a 23-year-old, struggled mightily when we moved from Ohio to North Carolina, even though some of my family was in North Carolina, to go, move 11 hours away and not know anybody for, 6 hours within any direction. I really think it was an unbelievable opportunity because I could just dive in and everything was basketball. And, as a 23-year-old to be, the youngest assistant in the Ivy League and, everybody I think in my family was just so supportive because as a volunteer assistant, you weren't going to get paid. How are you going to, I was trying to save money from camps and had some put away. Luckily, North Carolina was a pretty inexpensive school in state, so I wasn't hammered with, student loans. And you look at it and say, who did you learn from? And I had, Coach Thompson, was a great player at Iowa and had helped Coach Olson build things both at he went back to Iowa. He was the first ever assistant to work for Digger Phelps and not leave for a head coaching job, which I knew. And ironically, and then all of a sudden I met Notre Dame, 15 years later, but or not even that many, 7 years later. But it was great because, again, you talked about other assistants. I was working for the other two assistants were a former really good player at Penn named Tyrone Pitts and then Ray Jones, who was kind of, he was a 53-year-old, just, veteran assistant coach. He'd been all over the, he'd recruited Moses Malone before Moses decided to go to, straight to the pros. He'd been at Duke with Bill Foster and recruited Gene Banks. And so he just to kind of learn from both of those, gentlemen every day. And then, I think at Cornell, you saw a different side. You saw, the academic side and the prestige of the Ivy League. But, as beginning, there were no director of operations. There were no video coordinators. There were no player development coaches, And my second year at Cornell, there was no volunteer assistant. I got moved up on an interim basis for a year because we had somebody leave late. So I was kind of already filling a couple roles, and I wouldn't change that for the world. It was so good because you learned how to, for the first time, as a college graduate, you're trying to, figure out. I jokingly, one of the players when I was at Cornell my first year was older than I was. And, basketball is not a small world. And last Thursday, we got a call in the basketball office that our offices aren't open. So it gets transferred to our program assistant. And she sends me a text and say, hey, there's a player who says he played for you at Cornell named Alex Compton. He's back in Madison. and he's trying to connect. Well, Alex Compton was the player at Cornell who was older than me.
That's funny.
And had been was a fifth-year senior. He'd started at St. Joe's, but he's from Madison. Sat out a year and then played his last 2 years at Cornell. And so we caught up last Thursday, and you know, he's been playing overseas. His parents are in the Peace Corps. And it's just crazy. So he was able to play in the Filipino League because he was born in the Philippines. And then he'd coached for 12 years and he just came over. He was coaching and they got quarantined in March. And he just said, you know what, we're going to go back to Madison and see what happens. And they're going to stay here. And so it's really neat to continue, like to look back and say that first year you made that connection. And I look back and, you know, I had to figure out how to make do with a long distance relationship. And it was probably the best thing is that my wife didn't have to live with me for 4 years while I coached out of state until I moved back to North Carolina. So, it was great to go to Cornell. I just think there wasn't any outside distractions. It's not, no offense against Ithaca, New York, but it was all basketball for me. And I loved every minute of that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that always comes across is when you hear these stories about guys like yourself who were 23, 24, having just graduated from college, getting your first assistant job in whatever role that is, it's kind of like, again, you don't have at that point, you're not married, you don't have kids in most cases. And so, as you said, it just becomes basketball 24/7. And more often than not, you're at a place where, as you described, you don't necessarily have the huge staffs that a lot of Division I programs would have today. So you end up, that ends up being a huge benefit to you because you have to / get to, depending on how you want to look at that, do all these different tasks that eventually benefit you as you move on in your career. Because now if a staff needs somebody who knows how to run video or somebody who needs to know how to be a player development coach or somebody who needs to know how to book hotel rooms, you're like, I've already done that. And so I can fill that role, which clearly makes you more valuable in the next job that you get to. And so I think that that's something that a lot of people who maybe are not in the coaching profession, or when you think about players who maybe want to get into coaching, just like we talked about before, they don't necessarily realize all those little things that go into making a staff, making a team, making a program successful. And the fact that you were able to do that at Cornell in an Ivy League institution and get that kind of experience, I'm sure was invaluable. And then your next stop is at Lemoyne. So talk a little bit about that transition from Cornell to Lemoyne and how that happened.
Yeah. So, as I got the opportunity my second year at Cornell, to be able to do some recruiting, still in the days, the third assistant at that point on outside of the Ivy League was still known as the restricted earnings coach. I used to joke in the Ivy League, it's really restricted when it's volunteer.
Super restricted.
We went back to a full staff. I went back to, you know, the volunteer. I had no recruiting. I mean, I had that little amount of time and recruiting experience. And I think making sure you always treat people the way you want to be treated. I interviewed with Fran McCaffrey right when he got the UNCG job and got down to the final two. And, you know, somebody he had known who had been recruiting at a Division I level for 18 years is who ended up getting it over me. And so, the Lemoyne situation came about. It's funny, early morning workout at Cornell, you know, Dave Paulson had reached out. There was a connection between my brother and one of the kids that he had kind of mentored as a player that was going to end up playing for Dave at Lemoyne. And Dave had played at Williams for Harry Sheehy. And so Harry was on a sabbatical and they were just going all over to practices. And so David said, hey, can we come watch a early morning workout in the fall? And I said, sure. I said, you know, and so afterwards I said, the only thing is, could we go to breakfast afterwards? And just, I wanted to hear how they thought our workout was, what are other things we could do? And, so that was in the fall. Later in that spring, we stayed in touch, and then, you know, Tobin Anderson got the opportunity at Clarkson to be the head coach, and David reached out, and I know a guest you had recently, Sean McDonald, was his assistant, and Dave had me come in, and it was unlike, I had interviewed, at UNCG. I had done phone interviews, but Dave had me put a player through a workout and some different things you could do on a Division II level. But I think getting the recruiting experience is something I felt like I really needed to be able to do, or I was just going to maybe spin my wheels and continue to lose out on opportunities because I had something, you know. I think the older you get, you understand experience more. I think when you're young and hungry, you don't understand why just young and hungry can't trump experience.
Right, right.
But got the opportunity there. And so it's funny because Dave's like, well, you might be the only person I could offer a job to that I'm actually like, giving you a salary and giving you a place to stay. And it's joking. Like I'm a seven years in Division I basketball. My second year at Cornell, I got a salary for about 7 months and I got a stipend at Lemoyne for each semester. I got initially at that point, a 26 year old, I got a beautiful double dorm room in a co-ed dorm as a 26 year old. That led to, on Sean's help, becoming the freshman, dorm, director. And, if you want to have a dorm that's full of issues to handle, it would be the freshman boys dorm. But just little things like that, I think, Lemoyne was great because it was not an ideal year from a record standpoint, but I think I learned a lot because, I have a different personality. Then Sean's a little bit more, mellow. And I think even Keel, I'm probably a little bit higher up and down like Dave Paulson was. But I just think, sometimes in the experiences of things that don't maybe go the way that you would hope, you learn a lot more. And, I enjoyed being at Lemoyne, and then Dave got the job at Williams, and I went and it was, I think going from Ithaca to Syracuse, you feel like, good grief, you have too many distractions now. It seems like a giant, giant town. But then to go back to Williams, I felt like, oh, this is like way, there's like just nothing here.
And, right, right.
I was kind of at a crossroads too. I enjoyed working for Dave. Obviously, I thought, man, working, for a program that has a legitimate shot to win a national championship. And but I also knew that I needed to really figure out kind of the next stage of my life having dated somebody for 4 years and living in the same state for 6 months, that if there was an opportunity closer to North Carolina, could I find that? And so I kind of went back. I had a really good setup at Lemoyne. Steve Evans asked me to stay, and just felt like it was time to try to find something. And luckily, an opportunity presented itself in the third assistant spot at Elon, that was going from Elon College to Elon University. And that would allow me to be closer to home and continue kind of my journey as a coach. So I'll be ever, it's great because I think Dave and I kind of, we end up in the same league, on, obviously I was on the women's side, he's on the men's side when he got the George Mason job. So it's been a lot of fun. I got to actually, Sean and I were at the national championship game when Dave won the national championship. So in 2003. So it was pretty neat to see somebody who you knew is really talented and works like crazy, be able to go back to his alma mater and win a national championship was, something you look back and say. It started with coming to work somebody out. I think part of it is I worked somebody out so he could get a break from teaching at camp for a couple minutes when I came up on my interview. So
that's funny. That is funny. Well, what you just described is the glamorous life of a college basketball coach. All those things that you talk about, obviously when many people in the public eye think of being a college basketball coach, they think of the big jobs. They don't see the guys who are doing the things that you did as a young person to be able to work your way up into an opportunity where maybe you do have a little opportunity to make some money, where you do have an opportunity to have better control over your career. When you're younger, again, you're scratching, you're clawing, you're fighting to be able to just have an opportunity to learn, to continue to grow in your profession. And a lot of people, I think, discount those early years that people put in, and they only see sometimes that finished product. And I think it's always educational for anybody who's out there in the coaching profession just to understand how hard you have to work to be able to get to the position that you've obviously been able to get to, and we'll continue moving forward with that. But I just think a lot of times people discount that early part of your career where you're working for next to nothing and, you know, you're living in a dorm room and, you know, it's just that people forget about that.
Well, it's a great point. And I think I'm very quick to, you know, when people talk about a path, I said, mine's going to be really unique. And again, it goes back to like things happened at the right time, but they didn't happen in year one or year two or year three. Like, it was year eight. And for me, whether it's talking to, your players that are graduating, going on to the next step, or, managers or people that are just inquiring about coaching, you're going to get a long list of things that that are your job responsibilities. I will tell you right now, duties as assigned will be your most important job as you're coming up in coaching. And, I think having a pharmacy degree gave me, I think a level of confidence too, that I could go back and do that if coaching didn't take it. But, I like to tell people that, like being on college campuses, and this will be, for me, this will be my 26th year outside of being a student as an undergraduate. And I've heard a lot of people speak. And one of the best speakers I ever heard about was, to me, was explain why I'm in basketball. And I think, a lot of people in life love to do something, but they might not be very good at it. And a lot of people in life are really good at something, but they don't necessarily love to do it. And people ask me, like, did I have something against pharmacy? Was there an aspect I didn't like? And I did, and I said, I kind of tie that together. It was said, like, I found something that I love to do, and I had a belief that I was going to be pretty good at it and keep working to get better at it. And the speaker that I heard say this, and I can tell you, it was in 2000, at 2001 at Elon's commencement. And it was, he said, if you can find something you love to do and something that you're good at and those cross over, then you found your passion. And I think that's what I've always found in basketball is I loved coaching as much when I wasn't sure, 6 months where I was going to live or how I was going to move or figure that out or where I'd be. As I do now, as being a head coach and going into year nine. And so it's definitely a journey as trying to tell people you're not going to have the same path, and that's okay. And but if you can become, kind of have a survival mode and not just, and there were times I know I was frustrated and maybe this wasn't, and trying to get a master's degree in education and maybe think I would end up teaching younger kids because I'd worked for I'd run those camps for so many years and it was always a great, I think balance for me in the summer times because the Ivy League didn't have summer school for the players to stay and everything like that we paid for. And it was always a balance to me. And I'm glad the people that cared around me from a basketball standpoint always kind of made sure during the times when it didn't look like it would continue to go in a way that can continue to elevate my career and that they would understand I was still learning and continue to motivate me to continue on with the opportunities.
It's good to hear you say that you had moments where you kind of looked around and were like, man, is this thing going to work out the way that I want it to? I mean, clearly you had the passion, clearly you had the belief in yourself that you thought it was going to happen. But I think it's instructive for young coaches out there to know that it's not all going to be just a path of red roses laid out for you that here's how it's going to go and I'm going to be able to make it through exactly the way that I want it to. There's clearly times where it becomes difficult. Like I said, when you're not making very much money, when your living accommodations are maybe less than what you had hoped for, and you started looking at if you had people that graduated from pharmacy school with you that were clearly, I'm sure, making a lot more money than you were in the early years of your career, it's probably easy to look around and say, whew, maybe I'm not always making the right decision here with what I'm doing. And so I think that's really helpful for coaches out there to understand how you went about and made it through your journey. And yet at the same time, I think whenever we have moments like that, you go back to that speech that you heard at Elon and you say, look, this is where my passion lies. I'm sure over the course of time, you had gotten some pretty good feedback from the people that you were working with that, hey, you're on the right path. You're doing the right things. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep working and opportunities are going to present themselves. And so when you do that, eventually you do get your break. Eventually things do start to go in such a way that enable you to begin to elevate your career. So maybe talk about what that inflection point was exactly for you, where you kind of felt like, again, not that I've made it, but boy, I'm really catching a break here and this is going to be my opportunity to continue to move up the ladder.
Yeah, I think the opportunity I got, and as you've talked to people, like some people talk about if you go from the men's side to the women's side, you can't go back. And you know, I think the one thing I figured out, you know, in kind of being on the men's side is where I felt I had a bigger impact. And maybe it's because of what different schools fit me and, you know, kind of what I felt like was you know, to be at North Carolina, but then to be at Duke and be at Cornell and then maybe see a little bit different kind of student athletes you have at Lemoyne and Elon and even UNCG. But nobody's a bigger influence, you know, obviously than Muffet McGraw on the women's side for me. But, you know, Fran McCaffrey is the link to all these. And, you know, he's the link to somebody who told me no, you know, from interviewing with him, you know, as, you know, after my third year at Cornell to coming back around, you know, 3 years later and having an operations position and me being back in North Carolina and looking for a change and really, you know, that connection piece of Fran having been at Notre Dame as an assistant, having, you know, gone from being a head coach really young at Lehigh and being successful and then not being able to kind of go where he wanted to go and felt like he needed to go back a step, you know, was really eye-opening to me. And I think that whole year, from who I worked with, again, coming back to learning from different people around you. I still can remember when Fran kind of at the end of our season came in and said, hey, I want to tell you about this opportunity. You know, my connection, you know, my wife played for Coach McGraw at Notre Dame and she called and just said, she needs to hire an assistant. She's waited a year. She's kept somebody on as an interim. Ironically enough, that was one of her former players that is now married to Kevin McGuff, and who's the head coach at Ohio State. She asked him, did he know somebody? And I said, he said, I think I have somebody. I think knowing his background and having a sister who was obviously successful college athlete, knowing my dad had coached my sister's teams. And I always felt like every place I was at, I got to know the women's coach because that was just natural for me. And it was, you know, another person to learn from. It just happened that they coached the women's team and not the men's team of that, you know, the sport that I was passionate about. And, timing's everything. It's funny. And, you know, being with Coach McGraw for 9 years, I felt like, probably the time I figured that out was in my second year at Notre Dame. When I got the opportunity to interview, I was amazed with the number of people that maybe you didn't even realize who had coached in the women's game. So, you know, Chris Collins at that point, I had reached out because he had coached in the WNBA as an assistant. Not a lot of people knew that. And he said, listen, he goes, I'm coaching the best women's players in the world. And they're like sponges. Like they want to know more. And he goes, you know, people are going to tell you there's an emotional piece to it. And he goes, I'm not going to tell you that's wrong. He goes, but just the lack of ego. And when I got the opportunity, Notre Dame is similar, you know, Coach McGraw is 2 years removed from a national championship. And kind of needed me to do things that I had done, you know, for Fran from a scouting and even the player development side. And as I got there, I had just been married less than, you know, a year earlier. What they tell you, never to have the three things, you know, new job, get married, have a child all in the same. Well,
pulled off the trifecta. There you go.
We did. And so You know, later on in my second year, our daughter was born in September. And I think that was, to me, is coming home and knowing I was going to have my daughter. And if we had ended up having any more kids, we're going to have this unbelievable like set of like 15 older sisters to teach her and wanting the same things day in and day out. You're trying to build and fight for in a women's program was the same things you'd fight for your own child. And I can still remember it comes. You remember the losses, I think, sometimes way more than you do the wins. And
I do for sure. I can vouch for that.
And we were up 6 with 32 seconds left at home against Michigan State. And they hit a 3. We missed the front end of a 1-1. They ran a side out of bounds play. It dictates how I guard every side out of bounds play late game. We played a little bit off the ball, and the kid got hammered on a flare screen and they banged a 3. And I just can remember sitting in my daughter's room and after the game, and have watched it on film and everything, and just sat there and I watched her like just sleep peacefully and went like, you know what? I'm going to wake up. Things are going to be okay tomorrow. That's the most important thing in the world right there. And just to me, that was a kind of an eye-opening moment, was having that, knowing I was in the right place. I was at a high academic school, that we weren't just going to, when somebody graduated, you know, you weren't handing them a, you know, they weren't just getting a piece of paper. They were getting set for the rest of their lives. And how could I be a part of that, whether it be an assistant, be a head coach one day? I think that's truly I can point back to that game in early December of 2004 of making a huge impact in my career, of saying, okay, there's a reason that I'm in this position right there, and then that I hope I get the opportunity moving forward to keep being able to be that impactful.
Absolutely. What did you love immediately about coaching the women compared to coaching the men? And maybe the verb compared is the wrong word, but just what was something that when you came in and you were coaching the women's team for the first time that you're like, ooh, this is some piece of it that I really, really enjoy that maybe I didn't have the same feel about on the men's side?
Yeah, I think to compare the two, I kind of look back to back on UNCG and Notre Dame. And when I was at UNCG, I had been at Elon the year before, so we played against them. And so I knew the roster from the scouting report and everything. And, you know, Fran had gone to an NCAA tournament and then, an NIT berth. And so he had really, really good team. So I say those in a row because he had a point guard who was about to be a junior. And in his first 2 years, he had started one game. Ironically enough, that game was against Elon, but he started one game in 2 years. And I got there in August, and Fran had said, you have no idea. We spent 2 months waiting for this player to figure out if he was going to declare for the draft after starting one game in his first 2 years. And when I got to Notre Dame, I was going to coach perimeter players, and Coach McGraw's like, okay, here's project number one. Was a rising junior who, as a freshman, had been the national freshman of the year. As a sophomore, had made second team All Big East, but then had had a just had a bad end three games in the NCAA tournament. Shot like 6 for 43 from the field. She's like, you got to figure out how to make Jackie Batiste believe in herself. And I was like, she was like an All-American as a high school player. She was the national freshman of the year. And she goes, you're going to be able to tell her certain things that if I tell her, they're going to be personal. And if you tell her the exact same things, she's going to soak those in. And you have to teach her how to believe in herself and how she's going to be a really, really good player. And I think that balance of ego versus just having that, you know, knowing there's sometimes definitely and being, you know, being now, you know, this will be my 18th year on the women's side, is that balance of being a confidence giver and just fortunate to me that on the men's side at the same school, to me, is probably the best confidence builder. He's like, Coach Bray likes to refer to himself as his number one job is to be a confidence giver. And I think he's figured out how to do that amongst a highly inflated ego sports system in men's college basketball.
Yeah, yep.
And does it, his guys just believe, they always believe they're better than they are, but in a good way. And so I think to me, that's the biggest, you know, kind of comparison I can have from my own path of being on the men's side. I have friends who, you know, my first couple of years at Notre Dame are like, so like if like a, you know, like a full-time spot, like opens at like, you know, Elon, like you'd go back and take that, right? I'm like, no, like coaching at one of the greatest universities in the country for a Hall of Fame head coach with kids who have an unbelievable belief in what they're going to be able to do once they graduate from Notre Dame. And my second year, I got to coach my niece, you know, as a walk-on, and she's women's basketball version of Rudy, who got a scholarship in the end. And I go, it's just funny because you definitely, like a lot of things in coaching, until you're in it or hear about people's paths, what path you think somebody should take is very different from what they end up, you know, being able to do. So,
yeah. So how do you strike that balance between helping your players by instilling confidence in them and still pushing them to the edge of their comfort zone, for lack of a better way of saying it? How do you strike a balance as an assistant during those days at Notre Dame and now as a head coach? What do you do to be able to push your players towards their limit and yet still keep them confident in their play?
You know, I think consistency is the most important thing. And I think for me at Wisconsin, and even when I first became a head coach, I think understanding the other personalities that you have, if you're going to ask, you know, especially I think in women's basketball, if you're going to ask your players not to take things personally, you as a staff have got to make sure how those personalities work. And at Notre Dame, you know, jokingly, I coached, you know, perimeter players, more the wing kids, some of the point guards, you know, for 9 years. And some of the, you know, those players, like from basketball questions and everything, you got to figure out, who was really influential in their life, you know, and if you could figure that out and you could see the impact they would have, I think that consistency. I also think that you also knew they were going to go to female coaches on the staff for certain things, and you couldn't get caught up with, hey, wait a minute, I'm their position coach, why aren't they coming to me about that? And so I think being able to do that, being consistent, I think as a male coach in a female sport, they've got to see you. And I'm fortunate enough to be a dad as well. And I think they have to see that humanized side of you as well. And whether that's my family's around, whether that's how I think parental decisions I have to make, I feel like having a 15 and a half year old and a 13 year old now, like I'm seeing a lot of the recruiting, you know, that goes on.
Yep.
But I think as players trying to, you have to take a genuine issue and things outside of basketball. If you're going to ask them to focus in on, you know, being the best you can in these 2 hours and, you know, things I got from Dave on 22-2 and what he talks about, you've really got to be invested in their family. You've got to be invested in their academics. And you've got to understand that. And I'm really lucky because one thing Coach McGraw always talked about was just having people that have been in their shoes, and whether it's assistant coaches or video people or, you know, people that deal with their career development. And I've tried to be really intentional with staff building that way. And whether it's somebody who, and then knowing even as the head coach, that person might go to some, you know, I'm upfront about two things, Mike, to anybody that we recruit. And the first is I'm never going to be a former college women's basketball player, no matter how hard I try. I'm always going to have those people on my staff. And the second thing is I'm never going to be a mom. And now, you know, I've been lucky that I've had that on both of my staffs. And I think it's important they see me as a dad and a husband too, because I think you're trying to, the best players, the best teams I've been a part of have really good relationships. That doesn't mean you always got along, but you had really good relationships. And I think to push somebody hard, you've got to have earned that trust. And I think they've got to see you, you know, in the same way. Like our players will tell you like that, that if my, you know, kids kind of growing up were messing around at practice, like they got it the same way that somebody in practice got it. So I think that consistency, but I think also that my players know, like one of our, you know, just like talking recruiting, I think that's so important too, that kids see that, that how invested you can be, you know, in your kids' lives. They know then you're going to be invested in theirs.
All right. Two questions related to that. First one is, how do you go about building those relationships with your players? In other words, is that done? And again, I know there's lots of different ways that you can do it and that you do it. But when you think about being intentional, is that day-to-day conversations on the floor before practice, after practice? Is that team meals? Is that just a constant day-to-day? Is there a formal meeting? Like, do you check in once a week with each player and have a 5-minute sit down and give them a chance to kind of empty out anything that they want to talk to you about? So that's the first part of the question. And then the second part is, you talked a little bit about how you're never going to be a former women's basketball player. So how often, when you're talking to a recruit, how often does your gender come up as a question that either the player or their family asks? So you can answer those in either order. And if you forget what the second part of it is after you answer the first part, I'll try to remember it too.
No, I remember I'm a pharmacy grad, so
there you go.
I can remember science and math and everything. But
all right, good.
I think on your first, you know, the first area is trying to make sure it's a new challenge right now because of the limited access we actually
Absolutely.
Even have with our players. I think it's amazing what a FaceTime call versus a text message will have. It's, I think, adapting to whatever that individual is the most comfortable with. I'm really big on, I think as an assistant, some of my greatest opportunities to learn from a player was just rebounding for him and not going in with a set agenda and how that kind of, you know, leads to talking about their family or maybe even, hey, this is a class that, you know, and maybe they're struggling with, and then you get a little bit more information. You know, I do think as you talk about having being outside of basketball is really important. And I think trying to do that, we're lucky enough at Wisconsin that, you know, we have training table meals and we try to have our whole staff there. And sometimes we all sit together. Sometimes, you know, somebody wants to talk and you're over on the side, so it's private. I think having those type of conversations are really, really important, that they see you, that whether it's a good practice or a bad practice, you're still there and you're able to have those kind of conversations. I think one thing I've learned is just sometimes coming to the head coach's office is like the principal's office or kind of the white coat syndrome that people have going to the doctor. Is trying to a lot of times talk with players, you know, outside of my office. And I think my office is always open. And I think that's a lot of times great coach speak. And if we have a meeting though, and a player comes in, everything stops. But I think sometimes just sitting in the arena and talking to a player or sitting outside or meeting them somewhere. And I'm not a coffee drinker, but quote, having a coffee and being able to talk to them, I think it takes out the, as a head coach, I think as an assistant, they know in the end, as much as you're going to give your influence and give your opinion to the head coach, you're still not always directly, dictating how much they're going to play. And I think as a head coach, you've got to make sure that you have that trust to be able to talk to them about all things across the spectrum. And I make our players tell me, like, hey, where's the one spot on campus you go when you want to get away? And it might be, you know, we're lucky enough to be on one of the most gorgeous campuses in the country for 10 months of the year. Being able to do that. And, you know, during the quarantine, as you got to be, you know, how can you make sure, we're lucky enough, you know, we have five players that are kind of within an hour distance. And, you know, and I got in the car on Saturday mornings, was sit outside with a new player every Saturday for five straight weeks and just sat outside and social distanced and try to constantly doing that. I think if you preach to your team that you need to have good relationships, you've got to be able to extend it to your own life and be able to use those examples of whether it's your marriage, whether it's your, you know, how you're parenting. You've got to constantly work on those. And I think that's really, really important. I think the second part, when you talk about that, it's very interesting. And when I was hired, I asked Coach McGraw, similar, like, why have you always had a male assistant? And she, you know, she said, I could give you our roster and then I could go through. And if you wrote down the name of every high school head coach of each of our players, the name of every one of their AAU coaches, you would see between those two positions and if there's a father figure involved, how there's always a male influence in our kids' lives. And she said, I need somebody to provide that. And it's interesting now because obviously, like, you talk about great coaches, and she definitely leads the women's game right now into providing opportunities for other women in our profession. It is something that I think I want to give the kids that I, you know, will be, you know, lucky enough to coach one day as well-rounded an experience from our staff. And I think to me that is something that's former players and players at a high level and players from different backgrounds. And, you know, Coach McGraw, you know, I can remember her saying that's how she diversified her staff. And, you know, I was a male assistant with, you know, two black female assistants on the staff. And so I think she wanted to make sure and was always really cognizant of making sure that there was a different personality, what the backgrounds are of her staff to better help serve each of her players. And I think when people ask about that, like, I never sit there and go, well, like, this is what a male coach can provide. To me, it's that balance of having, I need to make sure there are really strong female role models in our players' lives. And if it means I'm not going to be that female, I'm going to make sure that every aspect that I touch that is going to affect them is that they feel comfortable going to those people. Because again, there are, I know right now, I can tell you at Notre Dame, who had a really, was really close with a brother on their team, who had a really special bond with their dad. And obviously I think every kid has a connection with their dad, but sometimes those were post players or point guards that they went to their position coach, but they came to me on certain things. And I think that was what was always amazing at Notre Dame is there was no type of ego issues within the assistants because we saw the greater good that it could provide.
All right, I'm going to ask you this question, which is unrelated, I guess, directly to you, but it kind of speaks to what you talked about in terms of balancing out your staff and the fact that many of the players that play for you and that played for you at Notre Dame had some type of father figure in their life. And let's flip it around and think about the men's game and the fact that so many of the men's players obviously had an influential female in their life. When, and again, this is a difficult question that I don't know that you can necessarily even answer, but just when we think about the diversity of a staff on the women's side of the game, it's kind of interesting that diversity has not, obviously there have been women's assistants at the Division I college level, but not very many. Do you see a time at some point in the future here as we continue to work through all the things that we're working through from a social justice standpoint and from a diversity standpoint, do you see a point in time and do you see the value in more women getting an opportunity in the men's game?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's really interesting to me because, you know, having, you know, I think several of the women who have been given the opportunity, you know, whether it be in the NBA, is I think where you've seen it more prominent. I now have been around when I watch them as either college players or WNBA players, and you saw the impact. Like, I was fortunate enough, when I was in Washington, D.C., that we got to know, you know, the coaches there. And I can remember, you know, it was a big deal for you know, Coach Tebow and, you know, his sons on staff and Marianne, when they got Kara Lawson, you know, to come back as a player, not just because she was from the area, but they felt like, you know, and you see it with a lot of NBA players right now, you know, NBA teams right now, who's in those, you know, 11, 12, 13 roster spots. It's a veteran that maybe they're not going to get as much out of a younger, but that's going to be able to help groom them. And I think, like, I knew at that point, like, well, I don't know exactly, you know, what if Kara Lawson would even go into coaching at that point. But I knew, like, that how important she was on a team like that, that it went back to when I was at Notre Dame and she had just gotten into, you know, broadcasting. There was never somebody to me who was as detailed as she was. I can remember she came after a practice, Coach McGraw had left, and she had caught me. Somebody was getting some shots up. And I can remember my kids are over in some, like, you know, Christmas party. We were, you know, at another part of the arena. And Kara was there for an hour asking questions about, we were playing Purdue the next day. And I think, you know, obviously Becky Hammon, like, you know, it's pretty neat right now because I think our generation sees Becky Hammon as, you know, as somebody who had the breakthrough and obviously works for as respected of a NBA coach as there is in Coach Pop. And I think as you have those, obviously Niel was able to do that this past year for Memphis and then move over. I think making sure that, you know, how can we affect that a little bit more, Mike, is we've got to be able to, you know, I hired a video coordinator, and one of the reasons I hired her is she was adamant she wanted to be an NBA video coordinator. And I said, what about a WNBA? And she goes, I would be that too. She goes, but, you know, I know as an NBA video coordinator, that could also lead to another step. And there's just more opportunities. And it's, you know, it's the greatest league in the world. And you said, you know, I love that confidence that she had, because I know that would be able to be spread upon my team. So I think it's interesting. I think when it starts in the highest level, that I think that hopefully we'll see that be able to spread itself out. You know, we're lucky at Wisconsin because one of our former players, you know, arguably, you know, one of the greatest players in Wisconsin women's basketball history is now a men's coach on the college level in Minnesota. And she'd coached a semi-pro men's team. And so it's pretty neat to see it happen right at home. And you just hope that those opportunities continue to present themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the opportunity is the key. And we all know that once you get an opportunity, then you can be judged on the merits of what you do in the job. And it's just a matter of, can you break down that door, that glass ceiling, however you want to phrase it, to be able to get those opportunities. I think once more women get those opportunities, we're going to see more and more that the things that they can bring to the table are just as valuable as the thing that a male could bring to the table. And then just like you talked about the balance in a staff, I think if you had more of a balance in the staff, there would definitely be strengths that a female coach could bring that it's possible a male coach might not be able to bring in terms of the X's and O's, in terms of being able to relate to players, in terms of, again, that influence that many of those players' moms may have had on them when they were younger. And again, those are things that are invaluable that I think it would be great for more women to be able to get an opportunity at all levels of the game, from high school, even down, you know, you think about where it starts is even at the youth level. You know, the number of times that you go to a, you know, a recreation league and you see the girls' teams being coached by a dad instead of a mom. And I think even opening up more opportunities for women to coach a bunch of third grade girls would be great for the coaching tree of women moving forward and moving up in all different levels of the game. Because then all those players, I mean, clearly you think about the number of female basketball players across our country today compared to 30 years ago, and it's ridiculous. I'm dubious of, in some cases, the value of AAU basketball on the men's side. I think there's good things about it, but there's also a lot of things I don't like. But on the women's side, I think it's inarguable how much it's opened up opportunity for girls to be able to play the game. And it would be great if it would open up the same opportunities for female coaches to be able to have opportunity to coach. And that would give the players who are playing, as you said earlier, role models that they could look at and say, well, look, this person's a coach. And so people can start to see themselves in that role when they see people who are like them, who are doing the things that they may want to do. A lot of times, you know, a female player can come all the way up and never have a female head coach all the way through their entire career. Yep. And so it'd be great to be able to see both so that you could have men and women both on the staffs of women's basketball, but also on the staffs of men's basketball. I think that would be something that the coaching profession, again, it's a slow grind to get there, but I think it's a laudable goal that we all should be trying to strive for, to try to be able to balance that out. Let's jump back to your transition from assistant coach to head coach at George Washington. What do you remember about your first couple of days on the job? What were the things that you said, whew, I got to make sure that we get this done? How did you go about building your own program for the first time?
Yeah, well, I got some opportunities at Notre Dame that, you know, just didn't see, I could wait, you know, and didn't just have to take a head coaching job offer just to take one. And, to me, again, as we've talked about, I just feel like I'm a better fit at a high academic school. And if that means maybe that limits who you recruit a little bit, like I had been through that, you know, and understood that and saw, you know, I think at Notre Dame and I was fortunate enough, you know, in 2011, we get an opportunity to play in the Final Four. We upset Connecticut. We lose in the national championship game. And I'd seen a path Kevin McGough had gone down, and he leaves Xavier, and Xavier's open, and it's a former Notre Dame AD, and Kevin's been there, and you get to the end, and it's a former Xavier women's player and myself and Mike Neighbors and the former women's player gets it. You understand that. And I think you can, you know, I think that's something I learned early on as a male coach in women's basketball. Just what we've just been talking about, Mike, is when we sit there and talk about, well, that person's not qualified and everything, flip over to the other side and see how many women's coaches there are on the men's side. And, I was fortunate enough that another opportunity could present itself and stayed, and we had another great run. And I got involved kind of in the George Washington situation during a recruiting trip, and we lived in, you know, the giant metropolis of Hinckley, Ohio with one stoplight. And when the George Washington opportunity is completely out of my wheelhouse, I've never, no matter where I coached, you know, never lived in a big city or coached in a big city. And I just didn't want to be a distraction. So I met with their athletic director in the week between the Big East tournament and the NCAA selection show. And then we agreed to, the loyalty to Coach McGraw that, again, I didn't want anything to take away. I'd never feel, right if somehow I felt distracted because I was worried about that. And we kind of got everything done. He asked if he could come out to Notre Dame and watch us play in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And I said, listen, I'm happy to say hi, and I can introduce you to the person who this is going to come down to decision making. And he watched our game and he wanted to watch me coach on the sideline. And then he spent about an hour and 20 minutes with my wife after the game talking, and it got kind of done. And I still, Coach McGraw was okay with me accepting it even as we were playing, and I just wasn't. and so we literally lost on Monday night to Baylor, and on the plane ride home the next morning, turned down an opportunity to interview at another place, and just said, this is the place that believed in me and waited for me through the NCAA tournament. And we landed on Tuesday morning. I told the players on the team on the flight home. And that Friday, which ironically enough was Good Friday, is when I was introduced as the coach at GW. And I can still remember that first weekend. You envision, I think, certain things as a head coach. And Coach McGraw put me in a lot of positions to make decisions like a head coach. I think quickly I saw really, really fast that not everywhere was Notre Dame. And we had a very good learning experience the very first weekend I was there. It actually happened. We flew in on Thursday night and the press conference was on Friday, and it happened Thursday night, early in the morning. And I think, like they say, nothing good happens at 2 a.m. Well, something bad happened. But I, you know, to sit and figure out and make that decision, and the ultimate decision on disciplinary action came down to me as a head coach within the first 48 hours I was there. But I was really lucky. I think getting myself acclimated, being away from my family, I'd already done that at Notre Dame and had been away from them. They waited, and you know, my wife waited until the end of the summer to come out to Notre Dame. You know, being in that situation, I think I was really fortunate to know. It gave me, you know, the rest of the spring and the summer to get to know the kids on our team and figure out which kids wanted to be up to the challenge and what we were going to do, and help the kids that maybe weren't ready to accept that figure out what their next steps were going to be. And I was lucky. I brought three Notre Dame people tied in with me on my first staff. So, you know, one is an assistant, and now I have to battle against her in the state. Megan Duffy, that's the head coach at Marquette, was my associate head coach at GW. I brought our director of operations, another former Notre Dame player, and then our assistant director of operations came and went to grad school. And that's really all I could kind of give to him, was that and a stipend. But it was helpful to, I think, in your, you know, when you're trying to look at your first staff, and you don't always, everybody, I think I was lucky that at GW, I had watched, I knew the tradition. And, you know, again, now I get to face it. The person that their tradition is responsible mostly for, in Joe McEwen, that's at North, you know, at Northwestern now. But I also then saw, you know, somebody that kind of was was the coach between Joe and I, who really only hired people that told him what he wanted to hear all the time. And so that helped me. I think being at Notre Dame and Muffet valued assistants, you know, input in that way. She didn't want somebody to be a yes person. And I think that was a huge step for me as a head coach, is making sure I hired, you know, I wasn't from DC. And I think DC, outside of what we know is political from the true political side, is also politically basketball-wise. And so hiring people that knew that area, and was fortunate that somebody I had known and had recruited her players was really interested in getting back into the college game. And then also made a hire that, just from a personality standpoint, you know, one of the hardest things you have to do is, I think you may, as a head coach, you coach two teams. You coach the student athletes, and then you coach the group of what your staff is. And you know, I made a hire that just wasn't a fit, you know, for our players, for myself, for, you know, the rest of the staff. And you know, it's I think one of those situations that you want to make sure that you're doing the best to bring the best out of somebody, but also you got to make sure at the end of the day, your staff is going to, what, you know, and players are going to, what, be, are able to control your future. And at that point, you know, we're married, moving into a place that we never dreamed we would live in Washington, D.C. And you know, I had to make a staff change. And that's, I think, something I tell, you know, new head coaches, is that, you know, as you're doing that, what's your plan? Do you keep a list of people? You know, good ADs, I think, always have a list of head coaches for every sport. And I think always, you know, I'm not sitting there right now. I'm really lucky. I have a great staff. But I've had to make decisions twice on changing the staff. And it is, you're affecting somebody else's life. And I think that was one of the things at GW. I was really lucky, because I had three people that knew what I wanted to do, but also three people that I think would tell me things I needed to hear and maybe necessarily didn't always want to hear.
Yeah, I can understand that. As you were going up through your entire career, did you put together a list, a notebook, a file of things that you were going to use when you eventually became a head coach? In other words, did you kind of formalize the process of thinking that, when I get a head coach, here's just some things, taking notes, trying to keep them organized, so that when you did eventually get the opportunity to run your own program, that you kind of had that as a reference that you went back to? Or was it more a case of, you had kind of prepared, you had kind of just observed, you had seen from all the great people that you had worked with, and therefore you were able to have an idea of what it was that you wanted to do?
Yeah, I don't know if I had a specific notebook. I have a lot of files. and I think always trying to look at that and what fits for the right period of time. And I think learning from when it doesn't work the way you thought it was going to work. And, I think I'm very, as somebody who's an extrovert, working for somebody who is highly successful as an introvert, I never understood the toll it took on Coach McGraw, whether it was somebody coming for a recruiting trip or even game day. And, I loved the earlier parts of game day because Coach McGraw is somebody that she would not come in on game day until, and at Notre Dame, when we were at home, we did not do a formal shoot around. We did a walkthrough an hour and a half before the game. I had been through that scenario because Fran had done a similar type of thing at UNCG. And, jokingly, she'd always say, it takes me the entire day to pick out the outfit I'm going to wear. But I saw it. I understood it because I could get a lot of stuff done, whether it was, making sure whatever the next recruiting trip was or, again, making sure my scout had been double and triple checked. But I think that's something that I've tried to write down more and try to tell younger coaches is the amount and so much of it, I think, is self-absorbed of mental anguish that you have as a head coach is because no matter how much you delegate and you hire the right people and you've asked them to make decisions on your behalf, in the end, those decisions are still the head coach's decisions, even if you're not the one that set them. And I think that was the way Muffet was always able to balance that was she knew if I can remember asking her the one day and she goes and she said, Sip, I got to be at my best from 7 to 9. And if I'm in the office at 10 in the morning or noon. And so you figure that I think that's one of those things you have to figure out what's built in yourself. And some people need to after shoot around. I need to be away from people for a little while. I just, as much as I am a extrovert and then before the game, as I'm getting ready and stuff like that, I like to have somebody around. But I think trying to figure that out, I did. There were certain things I tried to do right away that I felt like had worked really well at Notre Dame or I really had liked that I had seen. You just have to make sure you're not trying to pound square pegs through a round hole. And, I think that was something of it's still got to be fit your personality. And, and I do think that I'm really grateful because I feel like there were things that happened, from a learning curve standpoint at GW, that made me better equipped once I got to Wisconsin on how to handle certain situations. And, I think no matter, it's just, again, your first head coaching job, there's going to be a lot of trial and error and just understanding from the recruiting, from your staff, just, one of the greatest things I got a chance to do was the WBCA offered a program called, the Center for Coaching Excellence and just personalities at a table of new head coaches and seeing your way to do it is not the only way, even if your way still, it's going to be what I've learned from Dave Paulson and Fran McCaffrey and Muffet McGraw and Coach K and, Scott Thompson. And it's definitely, I think there's been silver linings of this quarantine and of being home and not having, and I've loved the chance to kind of recharge and learn from people probably I wouldn't normally learn from. And a lot of it's obviously been virtually, but I definitely think, keeping a lot of notes. You talked about what I wrote down. I wrote down like when I think recruiting, I always watched and who did I interact with that I thought, man, one day I think that'd be somebody I'd really like to work with and keep that of, hey, if we have an opening on the staff of and then being able to pick brains of people that, people that have had staffs that really seem to gel well together and why and what their responsibilities that they gave out, because sometimes just having somebody look through it with a different set of eyes. Muffet was really good at, if you came to practice, you could be a AAU coach, you could be a boys varsity or JV coach, you could be a girls coach. She was going to ask you what you saw and take your opinion on, you know what, that person maybe sees it different, maybe sees a player different than maybe we see the same thing every day. And it's something maybe we've ingrained in our heads only operates one way.
So let's take the quarantine piece of it out of it. And you think about how you learn and grow as a coach under normal circumstances. Here you are, a Division I head coach. How do you go about learning the game? What do? Are you going to video of other teams? Are you going and seeking out colleagues in the profession? Are you just explain your process for how you continue to grow and learn as a coach?
I think you have to be fearless. I'm just, if you want to learn from the best, reach out. And I can remember, you know, as a young assistant in the NABC and you know, going to clinics and I can remember, and I can remember going to watch Tex Winter, and I just sat there in awe. And now it's funny because everything kind of comes around with, you know, The Last Dance and talking about the importance and the influence he had with Phil Jackson. But when I got to Notre Dame, and I can remember going to the first, and so I interviewed at the Final Four. And I think when you're 2 years removed, Muff McGraw no more wanted to be not coaching in the Final Four than the man on the moon. And I can remember my first year as an assistant going to the Final Four, and I had the schedule of who was going to speak and everything. And Muffet goes, "Hey, who do you think is the best at garden ball screens in the country that we played against?" I'm like, "Well, like, you know, Virginia Tech's really good. Like, they guard them different ways." I felt like you could tell they were really good at, like, their personnel, knew our personnel. And she's like, "Okay." And all of a sudden I know, she's like, "Hey, from 3 to 4:30, you know, I think the first year it was in New Orleans, we're going to meet with Bonnie Hendrickson, who's the head coach of Virginia Tech." And so when we put our Princeton stuff in at Notre Dame, she's like, "Hey, you were in the Ivy League. Who was really good outside of Princeton, or who do you know?" And I said, "Well, Coach Carmody was, you know, had the team that was 29-3 and was ranked in the top 10. She goes, "You know, I think at that point she may have even said, is he still Princeton?" I'm like, "No, he's the head coach at Northwestern." He goes, "You know anybody? Can you get a hold of him?" And, you know, Paul Lee was an assistant at Columbia, is on his staff at Northwestern. And all of a sudden we probably in a 2.5 year span made, you know, 10 trips from Notre Dame to Chicago to sit at a practice. Or Coach Carmody was the only one of the original Princeton people that would really share. And Paul Lee, I still can remember, you know, send an edit to, "Hey, here's the exact edit tape we use with our team," and sending that, and we're looking at it and everything. And I think, you know, I think for our staff, you know, I know going to, you know, we went to NBA camps, we went to WNBA camps, and begin still trying to do that same, any opportunity you have with that. If there was an area that you really want to learn about, the amount of video that's available free of charge, just even online, is amazing. But
it is.
I think being able to, you know, we're spoiled with synergy because I can go get any game, NBA, WNBA, men's college, women's college. But I think being able to ask the question why, and you know, when I was at Notre Dame, we tried to put in, you know, we were trying to put in a, you know, a 3/4 court press. And you know, I can remember Muffet going like, "Hey, what did you run with Fran?" And I said, "Oh, we kind of ran this 1-2-2. And I called Fran, and Fran's on speakerphone. And he goes, "Hey, Sip, this is going to be crazy, but do you guys have like a fall break?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "What's your schedule?" And I said, "Well, you know, coach usually likes, you know, kind of to, you know, practice maybe Saturday to Tuesday and then let the kids go home." He said, "Hey, you know who Rolly Massimino is?" And I'm like, "Yeah, coach, I know who he is." He goes, "He's coaching now at a school in Florida. He's the best at any of the 3/4 court stuff." And he goes, "I have his assistant on my staff, you know, former assistant, Mitch Bonaguro." He said, "I can have Mitch tell you about it, but honestly, go down and spend 2 days with him." And sure enough, like, you know, Mitch gets me connected. Here's a guy I watch, like, one of my most vivid memories as a kid growing up is watching the, you know, the perfect game.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
When they beat Georgetown, and And I called and introduced myself, and Mitch had kind of made the connection. And he said, come down, you got to stay for more than one practice. And he said, now, if I'm going to teach you about this stuff, you gotta help us. And so I went down there, and shoot, like we sat there, and he's got Dennis Hobson, who I grew up watching play at Ohio State.
Absolutely.
As a kid, on his staff. And I just, again, like that turned into, he goes, hey, you know what? We should be learning. I know all these people. We should bring them all in. And 2 years later, he has a clinic, Mike, that is like people I still can't believe I sat in a room with and like learned from. But something small like that, where he's coaching at an NAIA school, I think people, especially on the women's side, feel like they will be like a nuisance to somebody. And I do think that is where the women's side is not as protective as the men's side. I think there's a little bit of a paranoia to share sometimes on the men's side. But being able to make a call, if you're an AAU coach or you're a eighth grade coach, I don't care what level, if you want to try to become a better coach, like our practice, we're always open in our practice, our shoot arounds, like being able to do that, I think is so important for us to grow the game. And, you know, just, we've had to do it differently, but I think in a normal sequencing of, you know, the spring of, I'm asking Coach Gard, what is he watching? You know, and just first looking at home. And I think if you're a coach somewhere, you know, I can remember being at Cornell and the lacrosse coaches coming to our 6 a.m. practices. They just wanted to see how you approached college athletes. And I just think that's one area that I think some people miss out on. It's an opportunity to continue to learn. And if it's a 10 o'clock Zoom call, which I think I've gotten pretty accustomed to with other coaches and everything. Yep. It's been a lot, you know, to me. I love that because I had people, you know, be able to influence me by challenging me to go do that on my own, that it's part of my staff's professional development, are to name the, you know, hey, who are three people you want to learn from, or where do you want to go for, you know, NBA training camp, WNBA training camp. The worst thing they can do is tell you no. And if not, I think most of the time, if you give them enough leeway, that most people will let you in to watch.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. And we've seen that sort of with the podcast. It's been kind of amazing to me back thinking about when we started. You know, I would have had no idea that the caliber of the type of people that we've been able to have come on the show from, again, the high school level all the way up to some NBA people that we've been able to have on. It's just amazing the willingness of coaches to share. And I think you make a great point that just reach out. And if you do reach out, more often than not, it's going to work out where they're going to be able to help you with either a phone conversation or invite you to a practice or whatever it may be. And I think that one of the things that I think has opened that up is the fact that, you know, you mentioned it when you said you can get any NBA game, you can get any men's college game, you can get any women's college game, WNBA game, whatever. It's really hard, even if you wanted to keep something a secret now, it's really, really hard to keep anything that you're doing a secret between social media, between the ease of being able to find video. And so I think what that's done is really opened up the coaching profession, where there's so many people that we hear talking to us on the podcast and I hear just in conversations of, look, I love coaching my team. I love doing the X's and O's. I love building relationships with my kids, but I also love basketball and I want to just help to grow the game. And I think that's something that trend has accelerated in the last 5 to 10 years. And I think it's going to continue to accelerate here as we move forward, just because the coaching profession, I just think, is filled with so many good people that are willing to share and grow the game and help to build it and help young people who are coming up in the career of coaching and really are trying to help those who are coming after them to grow and improve. And to me, that's a credit to everybody who's a part of the coaching profession. So let's talk a little bit quickly about Wisconsin here as we blow by an hour and a half in the podcast. Just want to give you a chance to just talk to me a little bit about what you love about coaching the Wisconsin Badgers women's basketball team.
Yeah, you know, it's growing up in the Midwest, I think, you know, it's a I think there's a genuineness, and obviously both my children were born while we were at Notre Dame. So even when we moved to Washington, D.C., You know, we took them out of the Midwest. There's a lot of Midwest in them. And when the opportunity presented itself at Wisconsin, there were some definite things of competing at the highest level in a conference that competes for national championships, not just in women's basketball, but across all sports. And again, I did not know Wisconsin of the places we had played in 9 years at Notre Dame. We had played in Madison once. We flew in the cover of darkness on a Saturday night, played a 2 o'clock game, got on the plane and went home. And so I did not know much about the campus, except my brother-in-law had gone to school here. And he just always talked about how beautiful the campus was and it sat on the lakes. And when the opportunity presented itself, ironically enough, Wisconsin had come to Notre Dame and played in the first round of the NCAA tournament, my second to last year. And so there was some familiarity there, knowing Coach Alvarez had been at Notre Dame. And when this job presented itself, one of the things that really stood out to me is women's basketball was not at the same level as men's basketball and football and women's volleyball and even both our ice hockey programs. And that was a really, really, some people may say, okay, that isn't that a red flag? And I saw that as an unbelievable opportunity. And, I think that being able to recruit high end academic students, Wisconsin is a top 30 school in the world, and be able to have a fan base that we are convinced, and now having a couple of babies in our program, that they change them real quick when they're born into either a red and white onesie or a golden green onesie, because you're born into the Packers and you're born into the Badgers. So, but for me. I think looking at our family and saying, where's somewhere that, you envision your kids being able to grow up, to be able to, have an opportunity that you look at, I think, as a college coach, of where would you want your own kids to go to school? And, I loved that challenge. I loved, what they wanted to go with the women's programs and the people they had hired. They had hired Kelly Sheffield as the volleyball coach 2 years earlier. And I'd seen Coach Gard actually got the job permanently the day I interviewed. And so I felt like I knew a little bit of his background, and that had always been, I'd been so fortunate the different places I had been at to have a good relationship with the men's coach. I think sometimes at Notre Dame, it was go down the hall and make sure. And I was kind of the person that was always the go-between. But I thought I could learn a lot and be able to really grow a program and recruit women that again, wanted to have that same vision and same challenge that I had and saw it as an opportunity. And I think that's what we're building here is, since I've been here, I've watched our women's hockey team win a national championship. I've seen Coach Chris, play in four bowl games and go to the Rose Bowl. I've seen Coach Gard, go to multiple Sweet 16s, win a Big Ten championship. And our hockey coach was a former Badger player here, who's a first-time college head coach. I love that atmosphere because in the end, there's not a whole lot of athletic directors here across the country who have coached. I saw Coach Alvarez's path. He inherited, not a lot of people remember, he inherited and he was 1-10 his first year. And I think 1-10 resonates in my mind, especially after I won my second game. My first year, I was like, okay, I'm one ahead of him. But it's also when I, in college, I went through Mack Brown's first year when I was in college, he was 1-10 at Carolina. And he's been phenomenal. I think you see his leadership throughout everything that's happened, magnified in the last 6 months. And I just love that opportunity to have that and understand that's the person who's the he treats our coaching staff of all the head coaches and the assistant like his own coaching staff when he was a football coach. And being able to learn from that and, knowing it's I'll be honest, I was really spoiled at George Washington to walk into a situation where there was an unbelievable wanting a really good talent base. We were really fortunate with some kids we recruited right away. We had a couple of transfers and just things took off. It's obviously been more of a slower climb at Wisconsin, but I've been really lucky in the kids I've gotten to coach and kids we inherited and now our younger kids and the kids we've even had that have been added to the program in the last year of that same kind of mindset that I think that the student athletes here at Wisconsin have been successful, the coaches that have been successful to be able to emulate that. And again, we play with some of the, at Notre Dame, it's unbelievable to me the network that we had. But we still at times weren't even the number one team in our own state. You know, there were Purdue fans, there were IU fans. Being the flagship school of a state brings a certain amount of pride. And it also, I think, brings a certain amount of responsibility that I really like because it helps me have that connection with the coaches in the state from every level and to make sure, one of my big responsibilities, there's no question my responsibility is to build a great program. And one of those pillars are how am I doing that on the grassroots level for all our girls and women's coaches in the state?
Yeah, no question about that. I think that when you have that opportunity to be the flagship university in the state, you have that recognition. And then, as you said, then you have that responsibility to go out and be able to advocate for the female players in your state and build relationships with high school coaches, and all those things ends up translating into success long term. So I want to wrap up by asking you one final question. It's a two-parter. The first part of the question is, when you look at where you want to take the Wisconsin Badger program, what is the biggest challenge that you have ahead of you in order to get that done? And then part two will end on a high note, which is, what is the one thing when you get out of bed in the morning and you think about, man, I'm going into work today, what is the biggest joy that you get out of being the head coach for the Wisconsin Badgers?
You know, I would say like an hour ago when you told me to remember a two-part question, that was a lot easier.
Yeah, exactly.
I think one thing right away you knew, and it's part of what you excites you every day is how good Big Ten women's basketball is top to bottom. And understanding you're going not only against some of the best players in the country, you're going against the best coaches in the country. And every athletic department in the Big Ten funds women's basketball, supports women's basketball at the highest level. I mean, there's a reason that every year there's double digit amount of teams that are in the top, 25 in attendance and the support and having to recruit against the best in the country. You can look at that and say, okay, is that something that's going to hinder us? I look at it and say it's going to make something that makes us better. And you know what? I think kind of you look at Jerry Maguire and he referred to himself as the Lord of the Living Room. For us to beat teams in the Big Ten, it starts in the kids that you recruit. And you've got to be able to have the right kids, find the right fit. You've got to win. You've got to be willing to go into those battles in the living room. And right now, those might be those battles on Zoom calls. You've got to have those type of players. And I think I look at it and I try to make that comparison. What is our goal for Wisconsin women's basketball? It's that consistency to be in the picture for a Big Ten championship year in and year out. And you know what? I only have to walk about 15 feet across the hall to see that consistency and the amount of, the top four finishes that our men's team has had 19 of the last 20 years. That's that same model of consistency. And, it is amazing right now because we have weekly Big Ten head coaches meetings and you just see the minds and the proactiveness and the foresight. Every week, you already have to go against it every game when you get to the conference season. But you see why those coaches are in those positions in our league. They're making you better. I always say that we might not get every kid we're in those battles, but you don't win any of those battles unless you get yourself into them. I think the second part of your question is, for us, I guess the other thing to add on to that is we know if we're in that picture for being in a position to fight for a Big Ten championship. You're going to be amongst the pitcher, you know, to be able to play in the second and the third weekend in the NCAA tournament. And I think that's your goal, is to get to the NCAA tournament and then use that experience to understand, I think, from every level I've been at and how you go about that two-game tournament. And I still use the same, you know, you put a bracket of two teams up. That's what we did. I can remember Coach K doing that, Duke-UConn, the year I was there. And that was the only goal, was to get to that next game. And I think I wake up in the morning knowing I get to go, and whether it's the staff I work with is on that same level, as I get to work with student athletes who I know are going to not only go to do bigger and better things while they're at Wisconsin, but once they graduate, they're going to impact the world. And, you know, I got a picture 2 days ago from a recent graduate who they know I'm very quick to on social media talk about our former players and what they're doing. You know, she's in the police academy and she wants to work for the Department of Justice. And, you know, she sent me her first picture as in full uniform and said, "Coach, you can't put this on social media." and I think understanding when you wake up in the morning and that's the type of young women that you're interacting with a daily basis, it puts you in that same perspective of that's the same goals you have for your son or your daughter. You know, in my case, having a daughter first, it's you know, knowing that she has those people to look up to, they're going to be successful. And I get to work with them and be in a partnership with parents that this is, you know, we had a Zoom call earlier tonight with every player on our team and every parent. And it's pretty neat to be able to know that that's the biggest duty I have is being in that partnership with parents and understanding I'm always going to treat them like I would my own daughter. And that's something a lot of people in life can't say. I think, you know, one of the things they talk about is as a coach, you know, some people impact a small amount of people in their life. Coaches get to impact such a greater margin or such a greater number that then will hopefully continue to go do that and impact people around them. And I think that's why I wake up. We've got workouts tomorrow. I think the only disappointing part of having workouts tomorrow for me is it's our last workouts of the summer. But I've appreciated that our team knows right now there's nothing guaranteed. And the fact that they've been to have a chance to come and do some workouts here over the past few weeks just leads to my excitement of how quickly I'm going to want them back so we can have that daily interaction.
Yeah, well, let's hope that whatever happens here that we do end up having a basketball season, a high school season, a college season. And certainly we know coaches and athletes are just itching and dying to get back out onto the floor. And I think that last answer kind of summed up everything that we were able to talk about and discuss throughout the podcast and just the passion that you have for your job and for your kids. And as a parent, I think is you know, as clear as we go through and me listening to you talk throughout the almost 2 hours here. It's just been a pleasure for me getting an opportunity to know you and pick your brain. And I just want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on here with us and share everything. Before we get done, you mentioned social media. Why don't you go ahead and share how people can find out more about you and your program there at Wisconsin, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Sure. I think the easiest is, you know, on Twitter, I'm at Badger Coach Sip. And just remember, Sip is spelled T as in Tom, S as in Sam, I, P as in Paul, you know, as well as following our program, which I got to make sure because I always do this one wrong. Because I'm so used to just
clicking. We'll throw it in the show notes anyway, Jonathan.
Yeah, so people can find it there. It's Badger_ Women BB. I'm just trying to type it in to make sure.
I know I do that all the time. Trust me.
But I think we're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. I'm more of a Twitter guy, so that's the best way to follow me. I'm on Instagram. It's way more of just following people than actually posting. But you know, it's amazing, even in the basketball circles of the people that you're able to learn from. No, I think that's the best way to follow us. And we've got a pretty dynamic group. We had an Instagram takeover today, so that's nice. A great way to follow us as well. They try to keep a lot of the Badger stuff under the same same handle. And I know ours, obviously, if you start typing Badger in, it's going to give you the option. And that's the reason that they started with that Badger. So I was really happy. I just had to change GW to Badger. and was able to fix things. So
there you go. Nice.
But yeah. So
awesome. Jonathan, we cannot thank you enough for spending almost 2 hours with us tonight. It's been a pleasure getting a chance to learn more about your basketball journey, learn more about what you're doing with your program there at Wisconsin. We're going to be eagerly anticipating the season and be able to follow you guys as you hopefully go through your Big Ten season at some point this year. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.